And welcome to Focus on the Delaware Valley. I'm Laura Lewis, and with us today, the Executive Director of Laurel House, Beth Sturman. Beth, welcome back.
Thank you, Laura. Good morning. It's so good to see you.
It is always good to have you in here, and I'm sad to say that this taping is going to act as your exit interview. We've been doing this show together for probably 20 years. How long have you been
19.
At Laurel House? 19 years.
But who's counting?
But who's counting? So we've been doing this show together for 19 years now. And you're passing the baton to Stacey Dougherty, who's been around forever. So Laurel House will remain in good hands. But for somebody who maybe has missed any of our earlier conversations, let's start off with what is Laurel House and give us that mission.
Sure. Laurel House is a comprehensive domestic violence agency. We're based in Montgomery County. For safety reasons, many times people turn to us for help from surrounding counties, as well as sometimes even from other states. We do everything from prevention education in the hopes of breaking the cycle of domestic violence with middle school, high school, and college kids, and then all the way through hotline and shelter and all kinds of supportive services in between, and follow-up services after people have concluded shelter.
And one of the amazing things about, because you've helped me put together panels on domestic violence in the past, is that help is available. And wherever you happen to be, and I just want to make this clear now, and because you do work together and agencies work together to make sure that someone who's reaching out is in the best, most protective space that they can be with the best services.
That's right. And there are every county in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania and as well as in the surrounding states, Delaware and New Jersey especially, have domestic violence centers that are available, that are very comprehensive, that are available to help people. And if someone calls us and they're calling from a space where, from another location where it would be difficult for us to serve them or for them to get to us for help, we do can help them get connected to the surrounding centers. There is also a national hotline that if people call the national hotline, that hotline will patch them through to whatever services in their area. So the help is available nationally.
What's different about when we first started talking all those years ago? Has the focus changed? Laurel House has obviously changed. It has grown. remarkably over the years. And we'll talk a little bit more about that because you've got everything from thrifts to support the cause. You have wonderful fundraisers, but you do so much work with teens and with other groups. So the conversation about domestic violence itself, has it changed over the years?
I think that, yes, it has changed over the years. I think there is, thankfully, less shame and stigma attached for victims, at least we hope for victims that have some awareness about the fact that they're not alone, that this is not just a problem for them. It's a very common problem in our culture and our society, unfortunately. There's more recognition that men can be victims and that nonconforming gender folks can be victims. There's more awareness that it's not the victim's fault, there's also, I think, more awareness that oftentimes the perpetrators need help as well, that maybe they grew up in a situation that was very difficult childhood, maybe they've had some other issues of their own, and that they're not, quote-unquote, bad people. They're people that need help. They're still dangerous people for the victims and for the other folks that they're connected to, but they're not bad people, and the help is available for perpetrators as well.
You know, I years ago I asked about rehabilitation for the offender, especially since so many people who might seek help on one day change their mind the next day and then change their mind again the day after that. And because of family ties are ties. Mm-hmm. And because when children are involved and perhaps they're going to have to deal with this person anyway, and sometimes the family does reunify, they get back together. And is rehabilitation now part of the conversation?
That's not something we focus on.
No.
But many of the folks who come to us for help do not wish to leave their relationship, don't wish to be completely separate from the offender, even if they're separated physically. They'd like to maintain some, or they need to, because as you said, Laura, with the children, they need to maintain some kind of a connection, some kind of relationship. If the offender or the perpetrator really has to want the help. So if that's something that the offender wants, we can. There's a organization in our county, in Montgomery County, that provides batterer treatment services, and there's an organization in Philadelphia as well, and I'm sure in surrounding counties. We can give that information out, but it's not something that we specifically focus on. We really focus on safety, both physical and emotional safety for the victim and for the children involved.
You mentioned that there's more conversation now about male victims and people with differing gender identification within the LGBTQ community as well. I mean, you've always addressed that population, but a lot of times the conversation centered around the next group, teens, but now talking more about men and transgender and, mm-hmm. and gay, lesbian population, et cetera.
So when we opened our new Safe Haven Center, which was a big move for us when we moved our shelter to a much larger space it's beautifully rehabbed. The very, very first person or family that came into our shelter was a father with a six-year-old son. And the fact that we have always served male victims in some form or another, but the fact that we now have a shelter that can accommodate both men and women who are victims as well as nonconforming gender folks is really it's been a tremendous asset for the community. I think the big change that we see, because we've always served male victims, is more understanding in the public and especially with law enforcement and the legal system that men can also be victims, not just men in same-gender relationships, but men in relationships with women as well. And we've had several situations where, for whatever reason, the man is in a particularly vulnerable situation with his wife. Maybe they're here on a visa. Maybe the wife is the higher earner, all different. Maybe he has some medical or physical problems. We've often been able to help those men who are victims as well.
Well, then that opens up the definition question here about how we define what is domestic, and instead of saying violence, abuse, domestic abuse,
right.
Because you mentioned financial, there's mental. Let's talk a little bit about that
sure.
right now.
Sure. So domestic abuse or domestic violence comes in many forms. It doesn't necessarily need to result in a broken bone or a black eye or any kind of bruising or strangulation. It can be, as you said, Laura, financial. Many times we've had folks who come to us for help who don't need shelter or don't want shelter, but who don't even know the password to the bank account, even though they're holding a job and, you know, they're earning part of the family income. So that financial abuse and not being allowed to have any access to the finances or being on a budget that the perpetrator or the offender sets and monitors very closely. It's very skimpy, usually a skimpy budget, even if the family can afford more. That kind of abuse, the emotional abuse for many of the folks that we serve, and they are men and women, but they're typically female. The emotional abuse, being called names, having their self-confidence and their self-esteem chipped away at over and over and over again. No one else will ever love you. You wouldn't be any good at that job. Things that are very controlling, so that with an attempt to try to keep the person as close to home and as close to the offender as possible. And that, over years, we've seen people who have had very good jobs, have had, they're college educated or have a skill set, unique and highly skilled training, who over the years get their self-confidence chipped away to where they do truly believe that they're not capable of anything without being connected to their partner. So sexual abuse, being not allowed to have access to birth control, being forced to have sex when they don't want sex, being forced to engage in kinds of sexual activity that they don't wish to participate in. So financial, emotional, sexual, there's a lot of, when children are involved, there's often control around raising the children. And also, if you don't do this, I won't pay for the children to have horseback lessons. If you don't do this, I won't let you take the kids to McDonald's. It could be anything from something that's very costly to something simple like going through the drive-thru at McDonald's. And, you know, people are very vulnerable to that kind of control around their children. So people who might not put up with things for themselves, but if I don't do this, I can't take the kids out for a hamburger, then I'm going to do whatever the perpetrator says because I want my kids to be happy. I want my kids to be taken care of.
One of the conversations we've had over the years, or one of the programs that you would do in high schools, and it would pull out the old control wheel. Mm-hmm. And that's what we were talking about just then: budget, emotional, sex, or holding the children as hostages, et cetera. The idea of control. And how do you define, or how do you recognize an abusive relationship?
For younger people, but probably for anyone, but certainly with the kids when we go into the high schools and the colleges and the middle schools, kids are starting to get involved with each other earlier and earlier. We help them learn about red flags and what might, especially in this technological world with these kids, what might look like, quote unquote, love at first. Well, he just wants to be with me. He just, or she, is constantly texting me, constantly saying, hey, send me a picture of where you are. Hey, you know, I thought you were going to be home by now. What's up? Where are you? Send me something to show me where you are. And at first it looks like, oh, isn't that nice? They just want to spend all their time with me. And then gradually what happens is the person, whether it's a young person or someone older, is gradually cut away from their natural support system, from their family, from their friends. So it started out looking like, isn't that nice? They're just so devoted to me. And then over time it turns into, wow, that's very controlling. So it's oftentimes the red flags are hard to spot. And we have folks who say, I'm so embarrassed or so ashamed that I didn't see that earlier, but it starts out slow. And typically it starts out slow and then it gradually builds up to where the person is in it before they even, you know, had a chance to recognize those red flags. So the constant checking up on, the constant asking questions, the berating, the, you know, I don't like when you wear that. I don't like when you see that person. Do we really have to go to your mother's again this weekend? I'd really rather just have the time by ourselves. And some of that may truly be, you know, loving, but then it crosses over a line. And I think it's hard for folks to see where that line is. So we, our hotline and our counseling program are very good at helping people see, like, hey, I'm not sure if this is a problem or not. Can I run this by you? And kind of to talk things out with our counseling is free and confidential, and people can come in and they can talk about their situation if they're not sure if this is a problem or not.
And you do have the anonymity of a hotline as well.
Absolutely.
And of course, anyone can dial that hotline and ask about someone else, too. You can inquire about steps. And that's my next question. When someone is starting to suspect that they are in an unhealthy relationship, when do they pick up the phone, and at what, and do you help them and coach them and prepare them for step by step?
We do. We operate on an empowerment model, so we certainly never suggest or force or try to force anyone to do anything they don't want to do. If someone calls the hotline and says, "Hey, I'm just not sure about this. Can I run this, you know, situation by you?" The hotline counselors are trained to just let the person talk it through. And they might respond with something like, sometimes people in that kind of a situation, sometimes it escalates. Sometimes we've seen it turn into other things. We don't know if that's what's going to happen with your situation. How are you feeling about it? To really let the person think it through and talk it through on their own. We've had people call the hotline over and over and over again. We've had people come in for counseling, and maybe they just come in for a few sessions and talk things through and then decide, you know what, I'm ready to break this off, or you know what, I want to stay with this, but I need help to safety plan so that staying in the relationship can be as safe as possible, and I need a plan for if I do need to exit quickly, how can I do that safely? So we do a lot of help with safety planning, a lot of help with step-by-step. Have a backup plan, have a safety word, have some place you can go. And if you don't have any place you can go, we'll help you figure out a place you can go safely.
Last time we talked, there had been just a spate of domestic violence incidents that ended in murder, murder-suicide, and just plain old murder. And you work closely with law enforcement, obviously, with emergency rooms, with emergency responders and all of that. Do you want to talk just a little bit about that? Sure. I'm going to leave that open-ended.
Sure. Thank you. We are very fortunate in our region and in our county. Our police, we've done a lot of work partnering with police departments, training police departments. Our DA's office and our law enforcement community are very supportive of the people that we serve, the victims that we serve, and work very closely with our advocates and our team. So we have a team that if the police department calls at any hour of the day or night, or if a hospital calls at any hour of the day or night and says, hey, we have a situation here, we can either, if the victim is willing to see an advocate, we can send someone out in person. If it's either not safe, you know, law enforcement determines it's not safe for a civilian to be on site, or the victim just doesn't want to see someone in person right at that time, then we will have an advocate talk them through options and keep in touch with them the next day, do court accompaniment if needed for an emergency protection order, that kind of thing. Our medical advocate goes out and trains primarily hospitals. We live in a region where there are a lot of hospitals, so everything from the registration folks to the emergency department, triage nurses, on through the long-term care medical providers, so that if someone reports with a suspicious injury and is willing to see one of our people or to talk with one of our people, they'll call us and we'll go out and meet with the victim. And we don't go out wearing Laurel House clothing and identification, so that if the offender is waiting in the waiting room or is in the exam room and maybe a medical person will ask them to step out for a little while, they don't know that it's Laurel House coming in to talk with the person that they've injured.
I think I've shared this one where I one time broke my own nose.
Ooh.
Oh, that was an embarrassing, sounds terrible, awful, embarrassing, and painful incident. And all the way to the emergency room, I was apologizing to my husband, you know, my reason for living, saying, darling, I'm so sorry, but when we get there, we're going to be separated at some point. This is going to happen. And I'm coaching mm-hmm. him through all the steps. Mm-hmm. And we walked in the door, and the first thing the triage guy says was, what, your popper one?
Oh, no. That's not what we train people to do.
I know. I looked at him and I said, you're not supposed to say that. You're supposed to take me aside and ask me if I feel safe. And that was the one and only incident of that. But I think all of us have experienced when we go for our physicals, when mm-hmm. we go in for an x-ray, everybody, do you feel safe at home is one of those first questions mm-hmm. that has now entered the medical vernacular. And and it is through the work that you've and your partner agencies have done over the years. But now you mentioned comprehensive help, and so somebody might walk in and they have nothing. Somebody else might walk in with a bag of money and the kids with school clothes and their school bags. Somebody else may need legal assistance, and you have all of these services available to them.
We do. The most people who come into our shelter, not everyone needs shelter, and thankfully, I think economics have just changed so that, you know, when the domestic violence movement started, which was originally called the Battered Women's Movement, women, you know, and I grew up in a generation where women could not necessarily have their own credit cards. They didn't have as many options. They couldn't travel as freely without a male partner. And so women do, and men, but women do have more options now than they did previously, or some women do, not all women, so that they may have another place to exit to, and they may have the financial capacity if they're not being financially abused, or if they've been squirreling away a little money on the side, or they have a friend who can help them with an airline ticket with a credit card. They do have more options for getting away without needing shelter. But we still, we have a 34-bed shelter, 12 rooms, 34 beds. So, you know, it's adults with kids. And we're typically full. If we have one or two rooms available, we're fortunate because there'll always be another caller who needs that kind of help. So most of the folks who come to us for shelter do, as you said, Laura, come in with almost nothing or nothing. We have to often help get immunization records, birth certificates, all kinds of things for the adult as well as the children to just establish, you know, a basic record that they need for school and for other services. We are very, very fortunate, and I know that our quote-unquote sister agencies in the surrounding areas are fortunate as well, that the community is very supportive. We have very generous donors who provide clothing, personal care items, toys for the kids, all kinds of things that a family coming in with almost nothing would need. We don't get too many folks coming in with a bag of money. And if it is a bag of money, it's a bag of change. But we do get people who have tremendous, you know, personal needs, as well as the help for domestic abuse and trauma that they've experienced. We get families, and this is, you know, the holiday season's coming. We get families who come in a day or two after Christmas or after a holiday, a gift-giving holiday, where the kids have had to leave their gifts behind. So we're very fortunate that we always have the generosity of the community. We can supply pretty much anything that a family may need, an immediate need that they may have when they come in. Now, the families who come into our other programs, especially our counseling program, or even some of our court accompaniment, those kind of programs, oftentimes they don't need those personal items. They haven't lost everything or haven't had to flee and leave everything behind. But if, you know, we keep in our counseling office, we keep a supply of diapers and other basic pantry items so that when a family does come in, if they do have those kind of needs, we can help with that as well. You mentioned legal services, and unfortunately right now we don't have a staff attorney, but we do work very closely with our county's legal aid group, who can assist with pretty much anything related to domestic violence. And we work closely with some family law attorneys in our county as well, who have been very helpful when the need arises.
And you mentioned you have some great patrons. You have people who have been dedicated to Laurel House for many years. But it takes a lot more than just a few. And we're getting into October is National Domestic Violence Awareness Month. And Laurel House always has fundraisers and events going on throughout the year as well. So do you want to talk a little bit about that?
We just had our Breaking the Silence luncheon, our annual. It's an awareness event as well as a fundraiser. And that was really great. And so that kind of kicked off the beginning of leading into Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Every year we have a fashion show, which sounds fancy, but it's not. It's a fashion show luncheon. Our models are board members, supporters, and staff who have a really great time. There's a boutique up in Telford, Shaquilla's Boutique, who dresses the models, but they don't have to wear 4-inch heels. So it's very comfortable. It's a lot of fun, and there are still a few tickets available for that. And again, the mission is baked into all of our events. So by coming to that and supporting that, it's fun, but people will also learn more about what we do and the help that's available for themselves or a loved one if needed. And then on October 20th in the morning at Upper Gwinnett Township Park, we have the 5K Dash, which has been modified on my behalf for a 2-mile walk as well. So if you don't want to run a 5K, you can walk 2 miles. And if you don't want to walk 2 miles, you can just walk part of the half the walk. And that's always fun. We usually are very fortunate with a beautiful fall day, and there's great refreshments. We have pumpkin dip, which is a big hit every year. And again, along the path, there'll be signs with different information about domestic abuse. There'll be tables with displays about our programs. And it's another great way to just come and learn more about what we do.
Well, if this is October is Awareness Month, and one of your missions is prevention through education. If I hear this, do you do outreach programs?
We do everything from, as I said, going into middle schools, high schools, and colleges. We've even done some healthy relationships training for younger groups. We've had Girl Scout groups that include some Brownie troops who have reached out and asked for that kind of awareness help for the kids. But we also do a lot for grownups. So we speak to Rotaries, we speak to other like Kiwanis, different kinds of adult groups to help educate. You never know where someone in that audience may need the information for themselves, a family member, a coworker. We've had folks who have heard us present at those kind of events and then been able to reach out and help a coworker that they were worried about. So we try to take the message out pretty much to any venue that gives us the opportunity. And then we do a lot of health fairs and community fairs, street fairs, where we have a table set up and people can come up and chat and pick up information about our services. As I said, oftentimes it's not the person who directly needs the information. It's a family member or a neighbor. And to go back to that just real quickly, we do support for family members and close friends who are worried about a loved one and aren't sure how to help and intervene. So we have a counseling group now for parents, or, you know, it could be an older sibling or an aunt or an uncle who are worried about someone in their family, a close, either an adult child or a sibling or a niece or a nephew, and they're worried about that person. And they can come and get individual counseling about how to help that person, things to do to support them without pushing them away and alienating them, because typically the inclination is to run in and save the day, which doesn't usually work. And then we have a support group so that people can find that there are other people who are going through similar kinds of concerns about their loved ones. So that's been a great addition over the last few years.
And a lot of these people turn into not just supporters, but actual volunteers for you. You have a big crowd that support you through the hours.
We do. And we certainly are always welcome new volunteers or potential volunteers, happy to share our volunteer coordinator. So on our website, you can get all the links to different folks within the agency. Our volunteer coordinator, Stephanie, is always happy to help with helping people figure out like the right niche for them. So we have a text line that we added during the pandemic. We always need folks to help, quote unquote, man the text line or staff the text line. We need volunteers for things like maybe just a couple times a year helping out with an event or sitting at a table with the information. And then even, you know, folks that want and are able to give a lot more time can do more direct work with our clients. A wide variety of volunteers, once a year, twice a year, you know, once a week. And then we have two thrift shops, as you mentioned earlier, Laura, and we always need volunteers. There's one thrift shop, Marion's Attic is in King of Prussia, and Laurel's Loft is in Lansdale. And we welcome, again, volunteers who can give a lot of time or volunteers who can just give a little time but would love to come in and help steam clothes or wait on customers or That's a very fun volunteer project. And those thrift shops have turned into not just a way for people to help out and for us to raise money, but a great awareness tool. Because a lot of times someone who would never call a hotline will come in and pick up information or chat with a staff member or a volunteer and learn a little bit more about what we do. And we always have the red flag warnings and things like that, that people can learn more about domestic abuse.
We are running out of time.
Oh,
I'm sorry to say that, especially as I said, this is your exit interview. And parting words. And they really are parting words this time.
They are parting words. So I've been very fortunate to be with Laurel House for 19 years. It's been a great experience. I've worked with fabulous people, both at the agency and in the community. And I'm really pleased that Stacey Dougherty, our new incoming executive director, she's been with us for 15 years. She started as an undergraduate intern and worked her way up and knows the agency inside and out. And I'm really grateful that we'll be handing the baton over to her. And I know she's going to do great things with it. She has a great team behind her. Thank you.
Okay. To find out more about anything Laurel House related, you have a fabulous website. Go to laurel-house.org. That's laurel-house.org. She alluded to a national hotline number, 1-800-799-SAFE. That's so easy to remember, 799-SAFE. And you can find out more about the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence at ncadv.org. But an easy thing to do is just either pick up the phone and dial 800-799-SAFE or go to Laurel House online at laurel-house.org. For the very last time, my guest today, Beth Starman, the executive director today of Laurel House. Again, find them at laurel-house.org. Beth, thank you for coming in today.
Thank you so much, Laura. It's great to see you.
It's great to see you, and we'll stay in touch.
That'd be great.
And I look forward to working with Stacey Dougherty, the new executive director, who will be coming into Laurel House, laurel-house.org once again. I'm Laura Lewis. This has been Focus on the Delaware Valley.